Back to order. Got three bills this afternoon. First one we started on the other day, 1099 Senator Rest. And I think we started to talk about an amendment, did we? Senator Rest, that food amendment, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did we want to take that out so we get some of the opposition out of the Senator Reinhart? I think, we've discussed it. So
yes, we did.
Okay, on that Reinhart motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Welcome back, Senator Rest, and you may proceed as you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. At the previous hearing, we did have testimony from people who are opposing the bill, which is a little bit out of order than the usual procedure, which is to have supporters first, but works out. And today we have, I have supporters, I have people to testify who are supporters of the bill, as well as representatives from the agencies that are affected or be stakeholders or participants in the updating of the Toxic Free Kids Act from 2009, and they're available to answer questions. So without further ado, I would like you to, if you will, call on testifiers in support of the bill, who will also respond or comment on some of the comments that were offered in opposition to the bill.
Okay. Whoever wants to, before you testify, just state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Marshall. I am co-owner of Peapod's Natural Toy Store in St. Paul, Minnesota. I also represent over 300 Twin Cities business members of the Metro Independent Business Alliance. We believe that with meaningful transparency rules in place under TIFCA, small retailers like myself will have the same access to product safety data which is currently available only to big box stores with the purchasing power to demand it. Our customers are demanding this type of information from us every day. Furthermore, moving away from toxins will also drive innovation and create jobs. TIFCA will encourage development of safer alternatives, a marketplace in which Minnesota has shown substantial leadership. Minnesota-based companies like BioAmber and Sagetis, which recently opened a new production facility on the Iron Range, are already bringing to market safer alternatives to BPA and phthalates made from corn instead of petroleum. The Chamber of Commerce's opposition to TIFCA is short-sighted. They argue that TIFCA would be duplicative of existing laws, but there are no comprehensive laws for these chemicals of concern in children's products. Minnesota's landmark law on BPA, for example, only covers children's food containers and feeding products. The Chamber also estimates a high cost of compliance, overlooking the fact that TIFCA would not mandate testing. It only requires manufacturers to know which chemicals they use and to report if they are using chemicals of concern. Simply modernizing products to remove these toxins would avoid any reporting requirements altogether. Businesses should embrace incremental reform like TIFCA because it prevents the need for sweeping overreactions, like the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008, which threatened the existence of thousands of small businesses by mandating expensive third-party testing for all children's products. I played a part in reforming the CPSIA to protect small toy makers, and I learned that Congress seldom listens to small businesses like mine. But the Toy Industry Association, which opposes TIFCA, not only supported CPSIA, but helped draft it. The voice of industry should not be just large corporations working to maintain the status quo. TIFCA is an opportunity to hear a new perspective and support small businesses, including the members of Metro IBA, who want greater transparency and safer products for our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadalko with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Peter Brickwitty, unfortunately, couldn't be here from the Department of Commerce, but I'm just going to quick testify on behalf of behalf of all three agencies, the Department of Health, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and Department of Commerce, that supports the Toxic Free Kids Act and is part of the governor's budget initiatives. We agree the amendments to the Toxic Free Kids Act are needed to increase the available information to consumers. enhance awareness, and allow for informed choices, and also give manufacturers incentives to reduce problem chemicals that are intended in products that are intended and marketed for children. And the bill proposes to do this in four ways. First, by requiring manufacturers and distributors of children's product to identify which items contain priority chemicals and to disclose that information to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that would make it available to the public. There was previous testimony that says this information is already available in the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse and other sources. Unfortunately, the Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse does not contain this information from other states. Right now, it does have a robust website, but it's more based on the policies, collection of policies of various states and not the actual data. Information that's being collected in Washington will be different than what's collected here in this bill. Information that's collected in Washington is at the brick level. So when you go into a store and you go to your favorite provider, say, of sleep pajamas for a child, that information in Washington just lets you know formaldehyde is in all their offerings. So if your favorite company has 15 different sleep bottoms, you don't know if it's in all 15 or one of the items. The advancement here in Minnesota's proposed changes is that it would be down to the UPC code, so an individual consumer could tell whether if they're shopping for ones with their favorite kid's action figure on it or favorite little princess on it, they would know exactly what it is and not only know the information in the larger context. The second reason we support the bill is because of through joint consumer education and outreach efforts regarding priority chemicals and children's products, increased information for consumers. And this effort would be spearheaded by the Department of Health and Commerce. Also, the bill provides grants to accelerate the development of safer chemical alternatives to priority chemicals and their incorporation into children's products. The goal here is not to have as many companies as possible on this list, but to get as many companies as possible off and not have to submit the information by them moving to safer alternatives. And finally, through a coordinated effort by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Commerce, it would help us ensure compliance with Toxic-Free Kids Act, but also other chemical restrictions and bans that have previously been enacted by the Minnesota legislature. Part of the data that we're getting from Washington is showing that there are a number of items that are suspected not to be following with the federal or state requirements on certain substances. It's because of these four items we believe it'll have the needed outcomes that we're shooting for. One, consumers having information they need to make informed choices. Today, they don't have that information to make in choices. Two, consumer demand drives improvements in products intended for children that are being produced and sold in Minnesota. Three, manufacturers and distributors have the incentive to develop and market safer alternatives to those priority chemicals listed in Minnesota. And that Minnesota will act as a center of business innovation for toxic reductions. And finally, agencies will build on efforts to reduce the potential human health and ecological impacts of toxics and products through enhanced awareness and compliance of existing chemical restrictions and bans. Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for the time. If there's any questions, I'll be more than happy.
Sure.
Mr. Senator Kosoko.
Thank you. What would be the incentive for the business? Isn't it more the fines? I mean, or is there some reward they get for doing it? That's just a brief question. Then I have one other question as well.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's a good question. It's really twofold. One is, you're right, they do not have to then go through the reporting system, which would have the reporting fees in it and the other work that's associated with reporting. And then two, they also are now moving to a product that has a safer alternative, which would open their markets up to more individuals. There's a large number of population that wants to know more about what's contained in their products, and having that information out to the public that they don't have those chemicals opens them up to larger markets.
I can confirm that in 16 years of retailing, if I have two products on the shelf and one says BPA-free and the other doesn't say anything, I'm going to sell four times more BPA-free product.
And Mr. Chair, I doubt that every business would consider it an incentive. You know, in the long run, it may be a good direction to go. I'm just not sure that they would use that term. But I do have a question about how many UPC codes do you think that we're going to have to track? Any idea of that?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's part of the information, the lack of information right now, is we don't have that information on how much individual items are out there have these chemicals in there. And so we do have estimates from Washington to show what it is on the brick level, but that's what we're going on today. And that's part of the reason for the bill is to know what is the level of individual products that have the chemicals in.
So Mr. Chair, what does Washington have as the number? I'm just trying to get a feel for what the number is.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if I can just have a moment, we can double check on what we use to run on the product categories.
Senator Jetson, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have several questions about the workability of what's in the bill. Because we don't have our own consumer protection agency within the state, we have to rely on, like the bill says on 2.5, state, federal, and international agencies to provide us the information on what to put on the list. Is that correct?
Sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the items that go on the list are priority chemicals that are designated by the Department of Health. And in consultation with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, we do have representatives here from the Department of Health that can explain that process and how the nine chemicals are on there today.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Jetson.
But it says in here that it would be evidenced by state, federal, and international agencies right in the bill. So my question is then, how do you let manufacturers know that if we're going to use, like, Washington State's information, and they list right on there that the presence of a chemical in a children's product does not necessarily mean that the product is harmful to human health or that there is any violation of existing safety standards or laws, the reporting triggers are not health-based values. Are we going to provide that information based on where we get what we put out on the website, like where it's coming from, why it's on the list? Where would that information be provided to the manufacturers or to the consumer, for that matter?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's part of the work that Commerce and Department of Health are. As you're correct, that's a very important part that needs to be established. So the communications and public outreach portion would be identifying ways to get that information out to folks in an easily accessible manner. It's not outlined specifically in the bill because that would be part of the program that Commerce and Health put together.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator.
Also, keep in mind that the various departments within the governor's bill are tasked with developing this system over the next 2 years and given an appropriation to do that. So it's not going into effect blindly, but the department is charged with coming up with the website and the procedures by which that information would be disseminated to the public and to the manufacturers.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I just am concerned that if we're trying to give consumers the information they need to understand the effects of the chemical that's in their product, that what we're asking for is purely existence of the chemical, which from what I can tell and information that I get, that doesn't necessarily mean danger to health. So I'm really concerned that, and I know the testifier testified to that, we're just asking them to say it. We're asking them to do a lot more than that. We're asking them to determine how was it in there, what's the concentration level, how was it developed, and then if you want to take it out, that you have to determine if it's necessary, the extent at which a child is exposed, which why would we need that? Because we're not asking what the exposure is to their health. We're asking, does it exist?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Jensen, that is certainly an objection that has come from the chamber in particular. But note that we're not talking about ambient existence of these chemicals in the environment. We're talking about manufacturers who intentionally include these chemicals, which have been identified as toxic, as harmful, that they intentionally put them in products to for a variety of reasons. And if they were not toxic, we would be supporting. We'd say, fine. They lengthen the shelf life. They improve color, whatever. But that's not what this is aimed at. And if the manufacturers do not identify these products with these chemicals in them, then the department is charged with looking at and contracting with others to identify whether the products, again, intended for children under 12 to be used by children under 12. If the product is charged, is the intended use is for people over 12, that's not required to be reported. For children under 12 to be used by them. It's very specific, and it's been identified in other bills that deal with toxic chemicals in children's products that we have taken some action on. So it is not as casual or as ambiguous, I think, Senator Jensen, as you are indicating. I don't know whether my comments give you any comfort, but I think that you're overstating what the requirement would be on manufacturers, and perhaps you've located some of that information. I'll
Senator
turn
Jensen.
Back to the PCA to further explain, if that's okay.
Okay. You want to take a shot at that? Yeah.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I wanted to get back to the committee on the question of how many folks have read or filed in Washington, and it's about 400 to 500 of the BRIC code level of manufacturers and the various codes. And so that's a doll, soft dolls, or PJ bottoms, those kind of categories. So 400 to 500 have been registered with their chemicals. It's important to remember Washington has 66 priority chemicals. Minnesota has 9. So there is a much difference there as a result. So those numbers would be lower in Minnesota.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my question is, if it's possibility of 66 chemicals, walk me through the process. I'm a manufacturer, and the department only the only thing that I could find that says that they have to report on this at least every 3 years. So they have a window of 3 years to put something on or take something off. So I'm a manufacturer, and I need to follow up the website, and something gets put on. And now I have 1 year from the unless it's the 60-day period that is a comment period, does it start then? Or does it start at the end of the 60, which will get set up by the department? Okay, so that happens. And I do my report, and I pay my fee. There's a fee for filing your original report, correct? Not just, you know, after you don't do it, but originally to put it in.
If the product, Madam
okay,
Mr. Chairman,
so it's in there.
Senator
so now
Johnson,
who tracks?
If the product contains one of the 9 priority chemicals that have been intentionally introduced into products intended for children under 12.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there could be a possibility of 66. That's what Washington has. So we put another one on. We've gone through this process. So who tracks for that manufacturer? They've made their report. Now they have 2 years for that one chemical that was put on. Who tracks the two-year time frame then to go back and reestablish that? Reestablish, did they still have it in there?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we would follow a lot of what Washington's done. They have actually published guidance on exactly what BRIC code levels for manufacturers to know what they need to report. So it's information that they would know what categories they need to report on. In terms of the chemicals are a priority chemical list that's maintained by the Department of Health, and they could talk more about the process on getting any new chemicals on that, but that does include a public comment period in addition to noticing that in the state registry. So there is the process to get a new chemical. There will be information on what type of products they need to report on. And then the last question you had about is if a chemical were to come on 10 years later, and then how would a company
or
be
a month
made
later.
Aware of it? If that information, if there was something that would come on at a later date, that would be the reporting schedule that's kept by the agency would be the informing companies, letting them know a new chemical has come on board. They have the clock starts at that time, giving the two-year period for that to happen. So that would be the part of the reporting structure that's being built by the agency and the website that would help provide that information along with updates from the agency, much like it's done in Washington.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I'm talking about the penalty, the incentive to not do it. Somebody has to go back in 2 years then and track that and see if they're still using it and when it comes in. Where I'm going with this is I'm concerned that we're going to get into this and we're creating our own consumer product area, and this is going to cost a lot more money than what you're originally, I believe, portraying to us. Because what if your income goes above on that company and now you've got a different time frame? And what if there's a mistake made in the reporting? And how do we do an appeals process for these companies that has to come forward and try to determine that I don't have that in there and now you have that process? So I think there are a lot more expenses to us as a state to monitor and regulate and provide this service to our consumers, which I believe in completely. I just think until we see what the governor's department sets up so that we know who's going to track the UPC codes and how are we going to know if those are being handled correctly, how are we going to determine when things move around as far as income? And then what if something comes off? Is there a process for that? And if there is by some chance that somebody gets a report that doesn't get recorded at the agency, what appeals process is available to them?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman and Senator Jensen, once again, I think what this bill is proposing is indeed for the all the three agencies that are involved to be able to develop and answer some of the questions that you are asking over the next 2 years. And this is not a full-blown reporting incentives or fees or penalties, however you want to think about it, that goes into effect July 1st of 2015. That's not what's happening here. So I think that there is certainly time within this proposal time for there to be extremely thoughtful discussion, taking into account the questions that you have just raised. And as opposed to the 66 chemicals that are identified in Washington, Washington State now, I think that we have been very deliberate. The Department of Health has been very deliberate about identifying the priority chemicals. It's a very open process. There's public comment, and that I think it would be incorrect to just assume that they willy-nilly put chemicals on this on this list as priority chemicals and are very careful about when chemicals have been added, keeping in mind as well that the Toxic Free Kids Act is not a new program. It is 6 years old. It was first passed in 2009, and Minnesota is not an outlier. This very day, Congress is hearing updates for the federal bill, TSCA, it's sometimes called. And unlike what's going on in the states, there are close to 90 bills, and I can't find the page right here, but I think I remember it. There are 90 bills being offered right now in 25 states. We are not an outlier. We are part of the mainstream in dealing with toxic chemicals in children's products. One of the features of the federal bill, the Udall bill, is to not allow states to move forward. They are going to preempt, if that bill passes as is, or has been presented, it will preempt the states from having any say-so. It will even prevent the states from having co-enforcement powers. That is simply wrong. It does charge the EPA with identifying high-priority chemicals. Do you know how long it takes there? 7 years. Do we really want to wait 7 years? I think that the work that Minnesota has been doing and the 25 states around the country should be leading Congress by the nose, and that we should continue to assert our leadership in this so important area where we are bound and determined to give accurate information and require about toxic chemicals in children's products. It probably should be in every product, but the major concern is children's products. And why is that the case? Well, for one thing, these toxic chemicals affect children differently than they do adults, and we all know that. Formaldehyde, which is, I keep going back to that because it's a bill I had before, formaldehyde affects all of us far differently than it does a six-year-old child. And so we focus on that because that is where there are issues of affecting development, physical development, mental development that we need to be particularly concerned about. So I appreciate the cautions here, but we're not an island among the states. 25 states are currently, not just Washington, which maybe was an outlier at times, but 25 states are considering initiatives that deal with toxic chemicals in children's products. Some 85, 90 bills. And so I would hope that we can continue to be part of that traditional leadership with regard to this area.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jetson.
Thank you, Senator Rust. I'm not in any way saying we shouldn't do something and we shouldn't do what we need to do. But my concern is because we're focusing on the mere presence of something and there are so many things at the federal level, when they do the research and have the capacity to do that, they look at the highest hazard and exposure for that chemical. It's not just the mere existence. So I'm worried that if we do this in this manner without portraying it the way other states have done too, that we're not including that scientific research on these chemicals and that we're actually giving consumers incorrect information. I don't know if we have an safer alternative list somewhere. I don't see that in this bill. I don't see it anywhere where a manufacturer or a consumer can look and say, okay, it's got this. What are the alternatives? What are the safer alternatives? We don't provide that to anybody, even the consumer. And I'm concerned because we don't have that research-based lab, per se, that does the research. We rely on other people to do it, that we don't get confliction for consumers and end up with something that's not as safe as the original and that we're expecting because of our language that they have to try to find other alternatives. Putting into place a process that we're creating something even worse because we don't know what it does. And that's going to take time to investigate and learn too. So I hope I would like to see more caution on this. If we could at least include some language about highest hazard and exposure rather than just the mere existence of a chemical, we would be providing the consumer with the best information, accurate information. And I'm all in favor of that. I'm just worried we're going to give misinformation and consumers will actually be making bad choices because of how this language is worded.
All right. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know who would help me with this, but I was looking at, and I understand it's been through judiciary, so I'm just looking for a little information. I won't argue the point, but in the enforcement section, I just was pulling up the section 115.071 that was referenced as the enforcement, and it looks as though you've pulled out the criminal penalties portion, but there's still, and I'm trying to, you know, make sense of this, but there would be potentially $10,000 per day violation penalty. Tell me how those would apply. I guess how would 115.071 apply if there was some issues? And then there's also in the issue, just so that you can answer it all at once, in the administrative penalties portion of that subdivision 6, it then references 116.072. And I'm not talented enough to make everything come up on my phone at once. Sure. So you could just explain all that and how it all fits together. Just interested.
Mr. Chair and committee members, good questions. start with the first, if a company would not report when it's reminded to on its two-year regular schedule, the first effort of the agency would be working with the company to get that information to the agency in a cooperative method to see if it was if they just had been delayed for a while or not. Subdivision 6 on page 8 on 8.84 and 8.88 allows for the agency effort to be able to get the information if needed in other ways to make sure that information is available to the public. So that's the standard work would be to do that, have the agency collect the work, and then allow for the agency to bill back that effort to the company itself. The enforcement would be, just like in any of our other enforcement with the MPCA, would be after there's been efforts to bring compliance through other means, notices of a violation, warning letters, and the like, and it would only be egregious cases where the agency would use any of its administrative penalty efforts. And the statutes you mentioned there outline the administrative efforts that the agency has in the penalty order, much like for anything from air violations to water violations. So they're the similar way it would be worked out if it is under the $20,000, it would be an administrative penalty order. If it was more, it would have to be an agreement that's worked out with the parties to reach an agreement so that there's some type of consent agreement on it.
Thank we you. Have Senator Rest, do you have other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chairman. This is our support group, and we've already heard from the opposition.
I see you got a list, a big list in here of healthy legacy supporters.
There is in your packets a list of the organizations that support and have supported for the last 6 years the Toxic Free Kids Act. So I hope that indicates how widespread the support for these initiatives are and the continued progress that the state of Minnesota, with the governor's support now, in terms of not with his support now, but with his support in that he is has a funding initiative in his budget, how important that is.
I have a Kelsey Johnson on the list here. Did she? She's with the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Welcome to the
Mr. Chairman, again, we're reverting to opponents, so I would ask that here
we heard
a supporter after we hear an opponent.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelsey Johnson. I'm Director of State Affairs for the Grocery Manufacturers Association. GMA is the voice of more than 300 leading food, beverage, and consumer product companies that sustain and enhance the quality of life for hundreds of millions of people, not only in the United States, but around the globe. Founded in 1908, GMA helps its members produce safe products through a strong, ongoing commitment to scientific research, testing, and evaluation. Thank you, Senator Rest, for making the change to the bill reinstating the food and beverage exemption. However, Senate File 1099 remains concerning, because it adds new, redundant, and unnecessary regulation to the sale of consumer products that will confuse consumers, likely increase consumer costs, and limit consumer choices. Minnesota is the only state attempting to mandate additional reporting for information that is already available. The $1,000 fee per product will eliminate many products manufactured by smaller companies from the store shelves, again hurting the consumer and driving the manufacturer out of the state. Some of the chemicals listed as priority chemicals are naturally occurring in the environment, and to completely eliminate their presence is not possible. The proposed language also requires reporting down to the Universal Product Code, or UPC. Each product may have between tens and hundreds of UPCs. The legislation would be ineffective due to complicated and costly compliance without providing consumers with any scientific public health benefit. Senate File 1099 requires reporting of a priority chemical's presence as well as extensive manufacturer and third-party testing of each product on the market to prove the amount of priority chemical and disclosure of the chemicals in each product for children 12 years of age and younger, regardless of accessibility or potential exposure. The Consumer Product Safety Commission, requires the exact same information and goes one step further. The commission mandates that a label be affixed to the product if it contains a priority chemical. Please bear with me as I kind of go through the details around the Consumer Protection, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It's already monitoring potential long-term chronic effects like cancer, birth defects, or neurotoxicity. All children's products require certain tracking labels for products manufactured domestically, and the importers of products manufactured overseas are responsible for having a tracking label. These labels apply to all producers, regardless of the size of their operation, contrary to the proposed law in Minnesota. The Consumer Product Safety Commission requires extensive testing for children's products and non-children's products that may be considered general use products. In order to ensure the testing of manufacturers' products, the Consumer Product Safety Commission accredits certain laboratories around the world. Third-party testing by the Consumer Product Safety Commission requires initial certification testing, component part testing, material change testing, and periodic testing. Senate File 1099 ignores other comprehensive and extensive safety measures already in place and the work of federal regulatory authorities like the Food and Drug Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Trade Commission, the United States Department of Agriculture, and many others. Our association recognizes the need to enhance product and consumer safety. We have worked diligently to reduce the amount of and use of priority chemicals within the food, beverage, and consumer products we produce. We are strong advocates at the federal level for updating the Toxic Substances Control Act and the Consumer Product Safety Information Act. Again, GMA supports strong federal food safety and chemical management systems. These are national issues, not limited to a single state. When a state does act, GMA supports a scientific, effective, risk-based approach. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify on behalf of this legislation.
Ms. Johnson here. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I think actually we, in the process of our conversation before her testimony, answered almost every single one of the criticisms, so I really don't see any further need to comment on her objections.
Okay, anybody on the list here that hasn't talked? I got Andy Hackman. Would you briefly? We've got other stuff on the agenda.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, my name is Andy Hackman. I am here on behalf of the Toy Industry Association. I understand you've had a long day. I'll just mention the Toy Industry Association represents the manufacturers, distributors, and importers of toys. 800 members. We have 170 toy companies here in the state of Minnesota, and they support over 6,000 jobs. So that's a perspective on the industry here in Minnesota. I'll be brief. I want to address one of the comments that was made earlier, that there's no existing federal program looking for safety in the toy industry. There are six different statutes and standards that regulate toy safety and children's product safety, including the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act that was signed into law in 2008, and it restricts five of the nine priority chemicals that are designated under the Toxic Free Kids Act. I want to also note that the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act ensures that our products are tested for reasonable and foreseeable use and abuse. And abuse is pretty critical because products are not tested generally in the consumer market for reasonable and foreseeable abuse. So we look at when a child picks up a toy, my daughter who's 6 years old, and throws that down the stairs. We have to predict and be able to model and ensure safety for all the endpoints if there is exposure from reasonable and foreseeable use and abuse. One of the points I want to make about the federal legislation that was being considered today, it's Senate Bill 697, sponsored by Senator Udall and Senator Vitter. It has eight Democratic co-sponsors on it, and it is, in terms of preemption, I think there were some statements there about it will totally preempt states from moving forward in this area. That just simply is not the case when you look at the preemption language. EPA would actually have to, quote-unquote, do its job in this area in terms of moving forward, prioritizing chemicals, and taking specific action on chemicals before any state statute would be preempted. Reporting, labeling programs such as the Toxic Free Kids Act, such as the prioritization that takes place under the Toxic Free Kids Act, would not be preempted under the legislation that was considered today. And EPA testified in support of the reforms that they in Senate Bill 697. In terms of looking at the scope of the reporting in this legislation, I've got the entirety of the reports that were done for the nine priority chemicals from Washington State here. 85 to 90% of the data that this legislation is looking for is available and is in the public domain. This is the 500 or 600 reports that were submitted. When you take this down to the UPC code level, you get tens of thousands of reports that are going to have to be submitted under this legislation. I do want to note some very pragmatic things, some pragmatic concerns that we have with this legislation. It was stated that Washington State has been first. They have broken ground in this area. Nobody was happy when Washington State finished their program. So maybe that's a good compromise. This bill, as it's currently framed, is not consistent with Washington State. And I want to highlight a couple of key points on where it's not consistent, where it's going to duplicate costs unnecessarily, and where it's not going to improve public health. First, inaccessible components.
I don't know if we need a description of Washington State's type.
It's just the difference.
We're just talking about the differences and how it's not consistent, and how if Minnesota moves forward in this area, it will be first in the nation in this area, and certainly not consistent in terms of being able to even share data between the two states.
Okay.
Inaccessible components is an issue that's addressed in Washington as a way to try to approach exposure. The legislation doesn't allow for inaccessible components. Due diligence is another critical provision. So if a manufacturer is reducing the presence of that chemical in their product, that's allowed for and it's considered in the Washington State program. It's not considered under this legislation. Chemical assessments and exposure data are going to require to be submitted under this legislation. That's not consistent with Washington. It's also not consistent with Vermont. I should have mentioned Vermont also passed a law last year. It is 95% consistent with Washington State. So there is consensus developing in this area of policy, but this bill is not there yet. The UPC code reporting has been mentioned by the department. It's a critical concern because it does create that tens of thousands of reports under this statute. There's no allocation or allowance for data reciprocity. Vermont very specifically put in their statute last year that they will accept reports from other states. That's not in this legislation. It was mentioned that there's a disclaimer on the Washington State reports. You'll see that on that data there. There is a disclaimer that says, while this information is reporting presence, there is not a safety concern that's documented with these products. They don't violate any national or international safety concerns. And that disclaimer is in statute in Vermont when they moved forward in this area last year. Unit sales reporting is also unique. It's not consistent with Washington State. And finally, the fees in this legislation are unprecedented. It's $1,000, and then you add another $1,000 every time you have to report. Vermont set their fee at $200. So to give you some perspective on where the fee is being set here, and then you would add an additional $1,000 every year from there. I understand the committee is in a hurry. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I can answer any questions. We want to be part of the solution, and safety is our number one priority. But this legislation is significantly different from both federal standards and policy progress that's been made in other states. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're here to establish a Minnesota model, and there are 25 states that are considering a legislation that follows their model. And some states have identified one number of priority chemicals, some others. We're not here to compare ourselves to Washington. I appreciate getting more information on the Washington law, but I'm not sure that it's particularly informative.
Yeah, I'm not that, quite frankly, as a chair, I'm looking at what we're doing here, quite frankly,
right.
Today.
Thank you.
And Mr. Quillis, I see you're at the table, but we didn't allow you to talk the other day, so we might.
I know, Mr. Chairman.
And
you
Mr.
Did.
Chairman, following his testimony, if we need to rebut it again, I would ask one of my supporters to come back
we'll
again,
see.
If that's permissible.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Long week, long day, Mr. Chairman. 2 points. When we talked about small businesses on page 5, from 5.22 to 5.26, whether by your gross income or by your production, you get exempted from this bill, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, the key, the whole key, and Senator Jensen pointed it out, and it's on the Washington State, it's on other ones. Mr. Chairman, the data should not be used to determine the safety of an individual product. This is not about safety, it's about reporting. Again, Mr. Chairman, the data should not be used to determine the safety of an individual product. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very
much. Mr. Chairman, I would also just end with that the... what we're doing is asking for data to be reported with regard to these high-priority chemicals. intentionally introduced into products for children under 12, and it is not banning them. We hope that all manufacturers, whether they're regardless of whether they have products for children, for use by children, or by adults, that they're constantly doing research, often funded by the government, quite frankly, to in our universities, to reduce these chemicals, these toxic chemicals. So that's my final comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, that's very good. All right, I think we've had pretty good discussion. We have anybody that wishes to move? I believe this has to go to the Finance Committee, too. Yes, yeah, there's money in here, right? Yeah, that's what I'm right. Yeah, that's what I'm told. So, do we have a motion?
Motion.
I'll move.
Senator Dahl, were you the first hand up?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate File 1099 as amended.
Okay.
Recommended to pass and sent to Finance.
Finance. Yeah. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Division.
You don't.
You just rule.
What did I rule?
Just say it didn't pass.
I don't know what I said. It's getting late in the day, but we're going to try this, no matter what I just said. We're going to ask for a division. All those in favor of Senator Dahl's motion, raise your hand. Okay, you got numbers? Opposed?
68.
That passes. On an 8-6 vote, the motion prevails. And thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much.
Senator Marty. Welcome, Senator Marty. You've been very patient. You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're all tired as well. We'll be fairly brief. Senate File 1215 is a bill that would ban the use of flame retardant, 10 specific flame retardant chemicals in a household upholstery and children's products. And this bill has passed, I believe, unanimous votes in both the Health Committee and the Environment Committee. The issue was, Madam Chair, the issue was that in the 1970s, I believe, one state proposed some fire-resistant standards that flame retardants be added to upholsteries and so on, and the industry responded and put them in, and they've been in there for the last 30, 40 years. A number of manufacturers are moving away from it now. The issue is there's been some significant evidence of harm in these particular flame retardants, and on top of that, studies suggest they don't really do anything to make things safer. As a matter of fact, they make it much more dangerous, both for people. 90% of Americans have these flame retardants in our bloodstream. Most particular harm happens for firefighters. And I have Chris Parsons from Minnesota Professional Firefighters here to speak to the bill, and then I'd be happy to make a couple more comments and then take questions.
Sounds good. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate File 1215. Here's what we know. That firefighters are more likely than the general public to contract and die from a wide variety of cancers, 2.5 times more likely for certain cancers. In the last 20 years, the rate of firefighter line of duty deaths from cancer has increased exponentially to where deaths from occupational cancer now accounts for over half of all firefighter line of duty deaths. A NIOSH study published in 2013 analyzed cancers and cancer deaths of nearly 30,000 career firefighters stricken with cancer from 1950 to 2009 and found that firefighters have much higher rates for a wide variety of cancers when compared to the general population, such as twice the risk for testicular cancer and mesothelioma, and more than 50% greater risk for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and multiple myeloma. Studies are also showing that cancers in firefighters are more aggressive and attack at a younger age. We also know that firefighters are more exposed to known carcinogens today than at any time in our history. The hazards of house fires have changed over the years from slow-burning building materials to today's small-dimensional lumber and synthetic finishes and furniture. Today's fires burn hotter and faster than ever before, emitting toxic fumes and exposing firefighters to high levels of carcinogens hundreds of times over a decades-long career. You could easily argue that modern-day house fires are more like hazardous materials incidents than anything else, and flame retardants are adding greatly to that toxic mix. When burned, halogenated flame retardants emit cancer-causing furans and dioxins into the ambient air. Firefighters must operate in these conditions and therefore are exposed to these toxins via inhalation, ingestion, and absorption through the skin. Ceiling temperatures in fire rooms often exceed 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And when you pair this with the fact that skin absorption of these known carcinogens increases 400% for every 5-degree rise in skin temperature, it's easy to see how firefighters literally become a sponge, taking in high concentrations of carcinogens through expanded pores in our skin. Flame retardants have been found in high concentrations in the blood, urine, and even breast milk of lactating firefighters post-fire incidents. We also know, and the sad irony here, is that flame retardants in upholstered furniture have proven to be totally ineffective. A peer-reviewed study published in the year 2000 in the journal Fire Science concluded that fires involving furniture treated with flame retardants only provide 3 extra seconds of escape time while producing twice as much smoke, 7 times the amount of carbon monoxide, and 80 times the amount of soot compared to non-treated furniture. And the soot is what contains the carcinogens. The ultimate question we have to ask ourselves is this: are halogenated flame retardants in upholstered furniture and mattresses worth the severe risk to firefighters' health and the health of the public at large? I say no, that they are not worth the horrible impacts to firefighter health and safety, and I hope that you agree and support Senate File 1215.
Does anyone have any questions for the author or Mr. Parsons? Okay. How would you like to
And
proceed?
Madam Chair, we have some others here to answer questions.
Just one second. Sure. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, in the handouts that we got, and frankly from talking with some of my local 101 firefighters, could you just talk a little bit more about it? I mean, there used to be some desire to have this from a firefighting perspective in terms of, you know, fires just being slower. But now that standard's changed, and it really isn't relevant anymore. So,
sure.
Mr. Parsons?
Madam Chair and Senator Reiner, the advent of flame retardants in upholstered furniture actually come out of a California statute from 1975, TB 117, and actually the cigarette industry is behind the whole thing. There was a big push in California to create a fire safe cigarette. Because back in 75, a larger percentage of the population smoked, and a lot of people fell asleep in bed or on the couch, and couch caught on fire, and people were dying in fires. Instead of incurring the cost of creating a fire-safe cigarette, the tobacco industry teamed up with the chemical industry and said, hey, you know what, we'll just put flame retardants in everything. Now, there's 84,000 chemicals in use. Almost none of them are, well, a very small percentage of them are actually tested by the EPA. A lot of us think that these chemicals are actually tested when they're manufactured and sold. They're not, to a great extent. So getting back to the California law, so the California standard, they came up with a standard that said you have to be able, a polyurethane foam that's in a couch or a chair has to withstand a flame, an open flame, for 12 seconds. So you can imagine putting a flame on a foam and the kind of nasty chemicals that you have to put in that foam in order for it to withstand that flame. The problem is fires don't burn that way. Nobody here in this room, I can guarantee you, has a couch that is just has a bare polyurethane foam. It has fabric on it. Some of them have wood construction. So that burns first, and then the foam, and then you have the soot. Getting back to the chemical industry and the tobacco industry, the chemical industry came up with a group of fire marshals. They found a group of fire marshals that went along with stating that, hey, you know what, flame retardants are good. They stop fires. Therefore, you know, we need flame retardants. They did not take into account the health effects of these flame retardants, okay, because at this time we did not know. Now we know. We have 227 studies that show that flame retardants are a public health risk, and now we're seeing studies on firefighters that are showing that the combustion byproducts build up in our blood, breast milk, and urine, pervasive. They stay in our bodies over time, and they're leading to high cancer rates. So that's the background on the California law.
And Madam Chair, just Senator to follow Reiner. Up, I you know, Chair Metzen is fairly frugal. He might have one of these couches that.
at my age,
yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, ex-member of the Congress.
Okay, I do have on that's the list some people that would like to testify.
And,
go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to say we distributed a letter from Dr. Susan Shaw, who did one of these research studies that was handed out. She was here earlier today but had to leave. But she points out again that there are more deaths, line-of-duty deaths for firefighters from cancer than all other causes, including smoke inhalation, including fire, including heart attacks, everything else. And Mr. Parsons and we had a St. Paul firefighter who testified in the first committee who showed how black the equipment gets, and the fact, as he mentioned, 40 times the soot from a similar piece of furniture that doesn't have this in. That's where the chemicals are getting into things, and because, as he said, their skin is very open pores and that hot temperature, it absorbs so much of it. That's the concern we have. So I hope you'll look at that letter from Dr. Shaw as well.
Okay, I think everyone has had the letter distributed to them, or it's coming around. We'll take a look at that. So I have Tony Quillis on the list. Welcome.
Committee, I will be brief. I want to turn it over to Mr. Simon and Mr. Osmitz to comment also. But Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Madam Chair, members of the committee, looking at some of the other rules and regulations regarding flame retardant chemicals across the nation, we have never seen a state law as comprehensive as this one. We have seen other ones requiring certain chemicals, flame retardants that are listed, some that are regulated, some that are labeled, but nothing that's this comprehensive, held to this standard that they're talking about of 100 parts per million, which is on page 2.1 of your bill, and then also all 10 that are listed. There are states, Madam Chair and members, that have done 2, 3, 4 of these, but not all 10 of them. Also, keep in mind, please, when you talk about flame retardants, one size does not fit all. There's different chemicals, there's different applications, there's different sizes of them. And give me an example real quickly. There is two uses that I know of. One of them is an additive when we put them together and mix them up, and you can measure that. But when you go through and use them, what's called in the reactive phase, you can't measure that. That's when it's bound inside the product, and you can't go through and measure that in parts per million. So that is of concern, Madam Chair. Also, the EPA right now is undergoing some updated assessments, and the industry is sharing all the data and testing information that we have with them. And then finally, Madam Chair, I mentioned it, the State of Washington Department of Ecology, who we had talked about previous bill, had been asked and tasked by the report by the legislature of the state of Washington to come back with a report. And one of their recommendations was to come back and test children products at levels that don't exceed 1,000 parts per million. So I just quoted from that report to the legislature, and Madam Chair, I just wanted to point that out, that we've never seen anything tested to those standards that are set on lines 2.1. Thank you, Madam Chair, and like I said, I'd like to turn it over to the two gentlemen that are
okay.
flowing in.
Thank you. For Thank you. So Robert Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Simon, and I'm here today representing the American Chemistry Council and its North American Flame Retardant Alliance, which represents some of the major producers of flame retardants used in different industrial and commercial applications. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and also look forward to additional opportunities to share information on flame retardants and some of the issues that we've discussed today already. Respectfully, today we're here to oppose this legislation, and I'd like to highlight four key points. First, fire safety is a real issue, and flame retardants are a key component of helping protect fire safety and public safety. The reality is that since the 1970s, we've seen a significant decline in fires, and that is a result of a comprehensive set of measures that have been put in place that include everything from sprinklers, but also include things like flame retardants that have helped reduce fires. At the same time, though, fire safety is still a real issue, and our colleagues at the firefighters can attest to this. In the U.S., firefighters respond to a fire every 25 seconds in the U.S. I mean, this is a significant issue, and it's one of the reasons why we have to rely on the firefighters to protect our communities. The second issue is, you know, flame retardants, as you heard from the chamber, include a broad range of substances. These are used in a lot of different ways for a lot of different products to provide different benefits. They have different properties, they have different characteristics, and they have different uses. And so trying to group all of these together, including the substances in these bills, which are very different, we think is inappropriate. And one of the reasons a variety of flame retardants is good is that there's different flammability of different substances. You know, a compressed particle board has different needs than maybe, say, a piece of electronics. And so those flame retardants are used in different ways, and that's important. The third issue relates to flame retardants and their safety. You know, these substances are assessed and have been assessed. Several of the substances listed in this bill have been assessed by government agencies and determined to not present a risk. And we think that is important to recognize. Just as an example, one of the substances, TBBPA, which is a flame retardant used heavily in electronics, a recent comprehensive assessment of the research in this area indicates that levels that you would see, whether it be in humans or the environment, are 7 million times below established health and safety levels. That's a significant safety margin, and I think that's, you know, something we need to recognize. And that has been recognized. The government of Canada, the European Union, have assessed TBBPA and made the same conclusion, that these substances do not present a risk. So another example of, you know, we're grouping a lot of different substances together here, some of which have very different risk profiles and uses. And then lastly, the fourth point that I just want to mention, and some of this was also alluded to, is US EPA is currently evaluating 70 different flame retardants, including, I think, all of the substances included in this bill. That assessment includes consideration of use and exposure, factors that we think are very important to consider. Given that this is ongoing and that these are a priority for EPA, we think having that information would be important for Minnesota to consider and encourage the state to look at those as you're considering regulating flame retardants. So in conclusion, you know, we support an open and transparent regulatory process that both ensures chemical safety as well as fire protection. Our concern with this bill is that you're grouping and banning a broad list of substances. All of the federal and state action to date has been targeted on a list of specific substances that might present a risk, and by regulating those targeted lists might actually help provide meaningful improvements to public health and also protecting the firefighters. So let me stop there, and happy to answer any questions, but I appreciate the opportunity to provide this information and look forward to working with the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. I think we'll hear from Tom Osmits first, and then we can have some people ask questions if they so desire. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to talk. My name is Tom Osmits. By way of background, I'm a... Am I on here? By way of background, I'm a trained toxicologist. I have a PhD in toxicology. I'm certified in the United States in toxicology and also in the European Union. I've spent over 30 years of my career really looking at toxic chemicals from the standpoint of hazard, what's the inherent toxicity of a molecule. We've heard a little bit about that already. And also especially looking at exposure and how you combine the factor of exposure and risk, factor of exposure and toxicity to determine risk. Because really when it comes to assessing what to do from a regulatory standpoint, priority setting is very important, and consideration of exposure is as important, in my view, as is the hazard. Several points I want to make regarding the legislation. And by the way, I'm here on behalf of the American Chemistry Council. I chair a science advisory council for the North American Flame Retardant Alliance, three toxicologists, three fire scientists who are independent, and we advise and respond to various issues that come up that are brought to us by the ACC. Three points. One is, you've heard a little bit of this before, the idea of looking at each molecule individually. It's very important to do that. I'll give you a couple of examples of why. Two, I just mentioned exposure and risk. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about the criteria you have for looking at replacement molecules. With regard to risk, we know that many examples of chemicals we're exposed to every day and the concentrations are low enough that we accept them. And that's a risk assessment that we all make ourselves or other agencies have made on our behalf. Many of the foods we have natural and synthetic chemicals in them, some of which can pose hazard at high levels, high doses, but we consume them and we do so without any harm. So considering exposure is very important. The issue of biomonitoring, and our colleague from the fire service raised some good points, that we find a lot of chemicals associated with fires and sometimes with flame retardants in blood samples and various urine samples that have been measured, and Dr. Shaw reported on some of those. The Center for Disease Control, among others, will point out that the mere presence of those chemicals does not constitute harm or a risk of harm. So it's really important to take data like Dr. Shaw's, which I think are generally fairly good data from an analytical standpoint, or Dr. Heather Stapleton from Duke University, who looks at chemicals in dust, and take a look at those as far as what the potential risk associated with those. And that's the next step of the assessment needs to take place. And it's really on the basis of that risk assessment, then you can decide what priorities should be established for eliminating or restricting uses of chemicals. TBPA is one that that Rob mentioned, heavily used in electronics. It's used both in reactive applications where it's actually bound and becomes a different chemical when it's used in the material, and also additive applications where it's put into the material as the material, the plastic is being made. There are two good examples associated with TBPA that are really worth looking at to better understand the concept of risk, and both of them have been published in the last couple of years, one by Environment Canada. It's a 500 or 600-page analysis, and illustrate two things. One, there's an extensive amount of material available from a toxicology standpoint. It's one of the best-studied molecules in the environment today is TBPA. Millions of dollars worth of work. All the data have been either been published or submitted to government agencies. So it's a very open process that the European Union went through and Environment Canada went through. And in both cases, they came back and said, given the uses that we see and the levels we see in people and in the environment, there's no need for additional regulation. So that's why it's important to take each of these molecules individually and say, what's the risk associated with this one? How is it being used today? What's the potential exposure? With regard to replacements, I think the criteria you have make a lot of sense, in the sense that you want to take care of chemicals where there's a high probability of various harms occurring. And as a toxicologist, when I think of known or suspected with a high probability, that really implies risk, because probability is associated really with risk. What's the likelihood of something occurring? And that has to factor exposure in. So if you take a look at the molecules you have on the list right now, and you look at the government reports, particularly with regard to TBPA, the one I'm most familiar with, the government, there's not credible scientific evidence by state, federal, and international agencies as being known or suspected with a high degree of probability to cause any of the kinds of effects that you list here. So the criteria you have for replacements, I think, are very good, but if you apply those criteria to some of the chemicals you have on the list, those chemicals wouldn't be on the list by the same criteria, and they'd be allowed. So with that, thank you for the opportunity and be happy to answer any questions.
Members, anyone have any questions for the testifiers? Okay, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, just, a lot of the testifiers were talking about some of these in general, but again, we're just limiting them, not for electronics or other things that were mentioned today, but for those specific items for children's products, upholstered furniture, et cetera. So while I think maybe some of the testimony is credible. I think, again, limiting in these very specific areas seems like a reasonable approach.
Madam Chair, Senator, I understand the idea of wanting to focus on certain areas, but from a process standpoint, again, speaking as a scientist, not as an attorney or a regulator, it makes sense to look at, regardless of what you're used to looking at, saying, are these chemicals used in these various applications? What's the potential exposure? Does it pose a risk? And if you apply those criteria and go through that process, you'll come up with a list that probably we'll all agree on, because there would be a significant risk, and then actions could be taken to actually reduce and mitigate the risk. But right now, it's difficult to see why some of these are on the list, and with the definitions sometimes a little bit fuzzy as far as what's a children's product and what isn't, it makes it very difficult to assess that.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just to the testifiers, any one of you, are the firefighters asking for this, or how did this come rolling out?
The firefighters are
Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Gazelka. Yes, the fire service, all the major fire service organizations in this in the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, the Fire Departments Association, and the Fire Chiefs Association, were all backing this legislation.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Ozimetz. And I'm sorry, there was a lot of information going on, and we sometimes tend to multitask. But, you know, I am moved by the what I'm hearing from our first responders. And do you have studies that show there are no carcinogens being emitted by these products that Senator Dahl said in the case of a fire?
Mr. Ozimetz.
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator, it's difficult to prove a negative, so having studies that show that something doesn't happen is not easy. But if we take a look at the study that was cited regarding the NIOSH study, the 30,000-person firefighter study by Daniels et al., it's a very detailed document. But they point out very clearly in there that they don't establish causality for any of those effects. The only causality they associate with is this mesothelioma, this lung cancer that's associated with asbestos exposure. But that detailed study, they didn't come back and say, well, this is probably due to the flame retardants. There's a tremendous amount of carcinogens present in the fire environment, and it clearly is a problem that we all have to deal with. Flame retardants may play a role, but there's nothing in the data out there that suggests that. In fact, the studies I've seen, especially the ones like the large NIOSH study, makes a point of saying we don't know what the causes are. But we do know there seems to be a slight increase in certain cancers. And for one cancer, that's the lung cancer, mesothelioma, there is a large increase. And that pretty much is attributable to asbestos.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But have you done any specific studies isolating at least this one type of chemical?
Mr. Ozimetz.
Madam Chair, there is one report that I could reference by Blaise et al. About 2013, I can submit it, that does take a look at the production of dioxins and furans, which are two of the carcinogens that my colleague to the right mentioned, in foam that has been flame retardant and hasn't. It was done in a laboratory, and if I recall, they didn't see any difference in the amount of those two formed when there is a flame retardant present or absent. So I can get that paper to you. I'd be happy to submit that.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, in the handout that we got from the professional firefighters, there's eight studies that are referred to that had some negative impacts to firefighters as a result of flame retardants. So I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming.
Mr. Ozimetz?
Do you have the copy? I just want to see what papers you're citing.
That was not a question. That was a statement.
Fair enough.
Anyone else want to come and testify on this bill? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, when I talked with the House author, Representative Jeff Howe, who's a retired St. Cloud firefighter, he talked about when he first started fighting fires, how he had lots of people trying to sell him cancer insurance. And I think that really hits home what the firefighters are experiencing. That's not something that's been going on forever. That's changed in recent years. I think the risk... Again, the fact that these things may slightly increase a few seconds of time that somebody can get out of a burning house, but it also makes it harder to escape because much more soot, much more smoke because of these, multiple times the soot, which is so damaging. I believe we're not trying to ban all flame retardants. We're only trying to ban these 10. There are plenty of peer-reviewed studies that talk about the toxicity of them, and when they're in a flame situation, I think the that changed the outcome. I'm not sure. I'm not the scientist. I'm not the chemist. I can just tell you that I think the reason the firefighters are making this as such a top priority is because of the risk to their health. It's more firefighters are dying from cancer and a lot of these rare cancers that they have much higher risk of than they're dying from all the other causes from fighting fires, flame and smoke inhalation, everything else. This is what's killing people.
Okay, Senator Reinert moves that Senate file 1215 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Yes, ma'am.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Senate file 135, Senator Lapps.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Lapps, welcome back to the committee, and we had pretty good testimony already, but we'll take a little bit more now. And before us is Senate File 135, Senator Lapps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Indeed, we did have substantial testimony on this bill last week. I appreciate the return to today's agenda. I do want to express my appreciation to our bipartisan list of co-authors, Senators Peterson, Metzen, Goodwin, and Housley. This is a bill that would ensure that collision repair shops have the ability to compete for customers and parts suppliers without violating mandates by the insurers that are paying for the repairs. That is, it prohibits insurers from mandating the use of a particular shop by the insured or specific vendors, products, suppliers, or price agreements for those supplies. And it enables the Main Street repair shops then to be a part of the repair system without unduly constraining their existing long-standing, often decades-long developing business relationships, vendor and supplier relationships. With that reminder of the key elements of the bill, I do have with me Kevin Wally, representing the auto glass repair shops, or the auto repair shops, to give further explanation and answer questions. And we'd appreciate your support.
Do you want to make a few more remarks tonight, Mr. Wally?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Wally, and I do represent the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota, statewide association of 700 independently owned mechanical and collision repair shops. I did have the opportunity to testify last week, and in the interest of time, I would simply indicate that we think this bill strikes a healthier balance in the marketplace, and we'd ask for your support.
I hear there was an amendment or something, or no?
No.
No, you're not. Okay. Okay, we're going to probably act on this. Is there?
Mr. Chair, if I can make a comment first.
Senator Kosoka.
Senator Lass, when we finished with this bill last time, we were going to send it down to the subcommittee because I don't think there's agreement yet from both sides, like we do on a lot of issues, and that is my concern with this. Earlier today, we dealt with the prescription drugs and how we handled those. And when they have preferred providers, they get a lower rate. But we wanted to make sure the other small town providers were not cut out of the pie. And so as long as they agreed to that lower price, that was not a problem. With the way your bill is right now, I believe that they don't have to agree to that lower price. They can charge a different rate. And if we don't figure out some way to work through that by the time we get to the floor, at the end of the day, it will drive up costs. So where I supported the prescription drug one, I'm not sure that this is quite there yet. And my hope, Senator, Mr. Chair, is that if it's the wish of the committee to move this forward, that we don't take it to the floor unless there's some sort of agreement.
I know we've been trying for that. Mr. Wally, I know that for years.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the
cost of a particular part is not the only driver of the overall cost of the repair. So we should keep in mind that there are often delays from repair or part suppliers that are not don't already have the close local connection with the repair shop or proximity to the repair shop. There are additional costs involved if the parts are not up to quality standards, if there are communication issues between repair shops and parts suppliers that cause additional administrative expenses in the course of the repair process. And that's also, especially with delays, can have a substantial impact on the ultimate consumer, the person whose automobile is being repaired. So we ought to factor those other considerations in when you determine cost. Simply the lowest cost of a part, as we all know, you can buy cheap stuff. It isn't necessarily good.
One quick comment.
I'll make it, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no matter where a part comes from, if it's a faulty part, that extra cost to bring it up to where it needs to be or returned is something that they would identify with the insurance company. We have a problem here, and that's taken care of. So that isn't a problem. And the other thing is for an insurance company, they want to get it done fast. A lot of the policies have car rental and reimbursement coverage, so it's not like they want delays. And so I'm just identifying that this is not like the bill we did earlier today where we're all agreeing to a lower price. It will increase the cost, and that's where my concern is.
Okay. We gave Mr. Wally a couple minutes here, and I think we'll give, in fairness, give Mr. Johnson a very brief.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We testified against the bill last week, had an opportunity. It's the same bill. We believe it strikes the balance on the wrong side of the shops as opposed to the consumers. The programs that are affected by this bill, the rec repair programs, you heard about that, are enormously beneficial for consumers. This bill impairs those programs, and by impairing them, it takes away the convenience, the fast, the concierge service, the no paperwork. There's a lot of benefits, and I just cited some statistics. I won't repeat that. It strikes the balance on the wrong side of the shops, to the disadvantage of the consumers, the cost of the repairs, and so we would oppose the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a motion, Senator Dames.
I'll move my bill.
Well, that's right. You're,
if I may.
You're a pristine, member of this committee.
Last I checked, I was still a member.
Yeah. Well, what happened, Senator, is you sit back here, see, and I don't always, but you're there a lot. You're here a lot, so.
Can we amend that or move that without recommendation, or how do we? I'm not sure how that process works. Well, no, he said he'd move his bill.
He's going to move it, yeah. Can we take another motion to move to?
If you want to amend his motion to do it
without a recommendation, is that your?
I would like that because we were going to do it in the subcommittee. That's not the direction we're going.
That keeps it alive. And
thank you. Mr. Chairman, I will accept that suggestion from Senator Zelka.
I think I was thinking the same thing, that maybe that keeps it alive, Kevin, and what you want, Senator Lance, and then we can. Okay. You're going to make the motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that SenFL number 135 be passed and sent to the Senate floor without recommendation.
Okay, everybody clear on that? Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Good work, Senator, and we're glad you came back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess. I want to thank the committee. It really put a lot of work and effort in today. And we meet Monday. We're going to start on the liquor bills Monday. Probably by about Wednesday, we'll try to enjoy that over sober up. Try to get a committee bill out.
Are we going?
But not on Sunday.
If you want to practice, go home tonight.